as diverse as jellyfish, arthropods, mollusks, and vertebrates. All these groups possess different eye types. So, how can the same gene influence the development of eyes that are so varied? At first, it was believed that all eyes are derived from a single ancestral eye, all possessing the PAX6 gene. But when Ernst Mayr pursued that idea, it began to fall apart. The geneticist who did the relevant study also found PAX6 in species without eyes and proposed that they must have descended from ancestors with eyes. However, this scenario, in which eyesight was first acquired, then lost, then recovered again, turned out to be quite improbable, and the wide distribution of PAX6 required a different explanation. It is now believed that PAX6, even before the origin of eyes, had an unknown function in eyeless organisms, and was subsequently recruited for its role as an eye organizer. Mayr then tried to explain away genetic convergence by appealing to the hidden potentials of the genotype. But that sounds more like a verboten goal-directed activity than the obligatory undirected process of neo-Darwinism. So the Darwinists have found no easy way of resolving the convergence conundrum. Convergence before Darwin. It's worth taking a brief look at the pre-Darwinian position. Well before The Origin of Species was published, convergence was understood and described by William Buckland, 1784 to 1856. An early paleontologist and geologist at Oxford, he would be called a creationist today. He published the first full description of a fossil dinosaur, naming it Megalosaurus. He was also appointed Dean of Westminster by his friend Robert Peel, the first British Prime Minister. In those days, science and theology could be intermingled without loss of prestige to either party, something that would be unimaginable today. Buckland was well informed about ichthyosaurs. He knew they were reptiles, but as ordinary reptiles, he also realized they wouldn't survive at sea. By 1836, he saw their convergence with fishes as proof of God's goodness, arguing that the resemblance of ichthyosaurs to fishes had been bestowed by divine fiat, or, as he went on, by the one and the same eternal principle of wisdom and intelligence presiding from first to last over the total fabric of the creation. Gould made a remarkable comment on this claim by Buckland. Read Endowed by Natural Selection for a modern version of the same argument, he said. That deserves a closer look. In identifying natural selection with divine fiat, Gould's statement could be construed as surrendering. But looked at in another way, it reveals how orthodox Darwinians see natural selection. They believe it explains whatever exists in nature, however improbable it might be, just as divine fiat did in pre-Darwin times. Seeing natural selection as all-powerful, they do not take kindly to a dispassionate scrutiny of what it can achieve or what it has been shown to achieve by experiment. Evolutionists, of course, believe that they are appealing to science in contrast to the religionists' reliance on faith. But the truth is that when they utter their two-word incantation, natural selection, they are not being remotely scientific, nor are they expected to provide any details. How could natural selection make two different and unrelated organisms more and more similar to one another? Evolutionists are never expected to answer that question. But if pressed, they would say something like this. First, some reptiles began to live part of the time in the water. Then one of them accidentally began to develop both a dorsal fin and a tail fin, so it survived better than the others. That happened again and again in many succeeding generations. Then one day, the fin reached a point where modern hydrodynamic engineers would ultimately find its design to be optimal. To today's biologist, in short, natural selection operates as an omnipotent force, just as divine fiat once did. Gould said he was awed by convergence. But perhaps he was even more awed by the ease with which natural selection functions as a password at any number of scientific checkpoints, with the assurance that no further questions will be asked. In the ichthyosaur case, for example, paleontologists are not expected to point to a sequence of fossils showing the bit-by-bit increase in perfection of reptile dorsal and tail fins. In a slightly different context, Dawkins once referred to the gradual ramp of improvement that natural selection needs to climb up. Such a series, or ramp, is never found with ichthyosaurs, where all the fossils are in their perfected state. But loyal Darwinists would view any request to produce such a sequence as quarrelsome nitpicking, science denial, and, perhaps, incipient creationism. As they see it, the problem was already solved, and solved in strictly materialistic terms, by Darwin in 1859. George Gaylord Simpson, 1902 to 1984, the curator of paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History and later at Harvard, once drew attention to the all-embracing nature of Darwinism, but did so as though it were a point in its favor. Animals from different lines can either converge or evolve in parallel or diverge, he said. Whatever happens, it usually has an adaptive basis. So evolutionism has all the bases covered. It is opportunistic, Simpson reassured us. What could possibly falsify such a theory? If one cannot measure the variables or the parameters with which the theory is constructed, Harvard's Richard Lewontin once wrote, the theory becomes a vacuous exercise in formal logic that has no points of contact with the contingent world. The theory explains nothing because it explains everything. More recently, advocates of intelligent design have suggested that biological similarity without common ancestry is the result of common design. Designers regularly reuse parts, programs, or components that work in different designs, said Casey Luskin. He gave the examples of wheels reused on both cars and airplanes, and keyboards found on both computers and cell phones. Computer scientists have given us more technical examples showing how very similar or identical sections of computer code are used in quite different applications. Convergence, then, can be seen in one of two ways, either as a sign of the awkward corner that Darwinists force themselves into by their embrace of a materialist philosophy, or as a biological analogy to the reuse of human designs in different applications. Intelligent design predicts that such reuse will be found frequently in nature, as indeed it is. Chapter 11. The Fossil Record. Darwin said in The Origin that his theory predicted a finely graduated organic chain, but he accepted that the fossil record didn't show that. It was the gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Darwin also reminded his readers that only small differences between parent and offspring could be allowed. Natural selection could not accommodate leaps or jumps, later called hopeful monsters by the geneticist Richard Goldschmidt, 1878 to 1958, who wrote The Material Basis of Evolution. Goldschmidt doubted that the small differences we do see between the generations would ever add up to anything. Darwin insisted that, by his theory, all living species must have been linked to their predecessors by differences not greater than we see between the varieties of the same species at the present day. It was a severe and admirable limit that he imposed on his own theory. Those ancestors, although now generally extinct, he believed, were similarly connected with much more ancient species, and so on backwards, always converging to the common ancestor of each great class. But if that were the case, the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory be true, such have lived upon this earth. In a letter to Darwin, written the day before The Origin was published, his ally, Thomas H. Huxley, saw a problem. You have loaded yourself with an unnecessary difficulty in adopting natura non facit saltum, nature doesn't make jumps, So unreservedly, Huxley wrote. He believed that nature does, in fact, make small jumps, but he gave no details. On his round-the-world voyage aboard HMS Beagle, Darwin took Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology with him. The book convinced him that the Earth was ancient, which was a requirement for his theory. But the fossil record didn't offer much in the way of support. Admittedly, only a small part of the Earth had been explored, and some species are known from a single fossil. Wholly soft organisms could not be preserved. Not so, as it turned out. And shells and bones on the seafloor soon decayed. Nonetheless, a profusion of finely graded fossils should be down there somewhere. Yet fossil hunters hadn't been able to find them. His theory-saving solution became well known. It was that the geological record was highly imperfect. Most of the intermediates were never preserved at all, he assumed. So more excavations were called for. Maybe they would turn up at least some of the missing intermediate forms. Almost immediately, a 150 million-year-old Archaeopteryx fossil was discovered in Bavaria. That was in 1861, and since then several more specimens have been found. Archaeopteryx, with teeth, feathers, and clawed wings, seemed to bridge the gap between dinosaurs and birds, giving Darwin's theory an immediate boost. Though some modern birds, such as the hoedzin, also have clawed wings. The digging has persisted around the world for 150 years since then, and about 250,000 fossil species have been identified. According to Michael Denton, so vast has been the expansion of paleontological activity over the past 100 years that probably 99.9% of all paleontological work has been carried out since 1860. A spokesman for the American Association for the Advancement of Science said in the 1980s that 100 million fossils have been identified and that they constitute 100 million facts that prove evolution beyond any doubt whatever. But fossils, of course, do not make the case for Darwinism. Absent finely graded sequences, the fossil remains of organisms do not imply or disclose ancestor-descendant relationships. Yet Harvard's Ernst Mayr, one of the leading Darwinians of the 20th century, wrote in What Evolution Is, "The most convincing evidence for the occurrence of evolution is the discovery of extinct organisms in older geological strata. Eventually, the evidence for the conclusion that the world is not constant but forever changing became so overwhelming that it could no longer be denied." The problem is that Mayer's indisputable but weak claim that the world is forever changing does nothing to establish ancestry and descent. Henry G., a senior editor of Nature, wrote in 1999, "The attribution of ancestry does not come from the fossil. It can only come from us. Fossils are mute. Their silence gives us unlimited license to tell their stories for them, which usually take the form of chains of ancestry and descent. It is effectively impossible to link fossils into chains of cause and effect in any valid way, whether we're talking about the extinction of the dinosaurs or chains of ancestry and descent. Everything we think we know about the causal relations of events in deep time have been invented by us after the fact." We can measure our knowledge of the completeness of collections, not just of fossils, but of any artifact, postage stamps, for example, by plotting what are known as collector's curves. Scientists use them to measure the extent of many different types of collections. When we start collecting anything, each new item or specimen is one we have not seen before. Then, as we keep finding more, we are likely to find that most are already familiar to us. At that point, our collector's curve begins to level off. Increasingly, our response is likely to be, "Oh, we've already seen one of those." Casey Luskin says that when paleontologists see this leveling off, their knowledge of the different types of specimens is relatively complete. That's where we are today. A paper published in Nature in 2000 found that among the higher taxonomic categories, family and above, The past 540 million years of the fossil record provide uniformly good documentation of the life of the past. Michael Foote, a professor of paleontology at the University of Chicago, asked in 1997, "We would like to know whether we have a representative sample of morphological diversity and therefore can rely on patterns documented in the fossil record." He concluded, "Although we still have much to learn about the evolution of form, in many respects, our view of the history of biological diversity is mature." He used the statistical method outlined above. Foote's paper was cited by Stephen Meyer in his book Darwin's Doubt, 2013. "As more and more fossils are discovered," Meyer wrote, "and as they fail to document the great array of intermediate forms, it grows ever more improbable that their absence is an artifact of either incomplete sampling or preservation." The broadest category of animal life is known as a phylum. The difference in morphology between a member of one phylum and another is vast. Think of the distance between chordates, which include vertebrates, arthropods, insects, beetles, spiders, annelids, worms, and mollusks, squids, snails. Yet to this day, paleontologists have failed to find forms that fill up these chasms of morphological space. Meyer wrote, "Foote's statistical analysis of this pattern, documented by an ever-increasing number of paleontological investigations, demonstrates just how improbable it is that there ever existed a myriad of as yet undiscovered intermediate forms of animal life. Forms that could close the morphological distance between the Cambrian phyla one tiny evolutionary step at a time." In The Design of Life, 2008, William A. Dembski and Jonathan Wells approached the same question from the opposite direction. "We can count the types of organisms living today and then compare them with the number found in fossilized form. The percentage recovered as fossils gives us a good indication of the completeness of the fossil record." They gave this example. "Among 43 living orders of terrestrial vertebrates, the level of classification just below classes and phyla, 42 have been found as fossils. Carnivores are one such order. Thus, 98% of extant terrestrial vertebrates at that level of classification were fossilized. It is therefore a good bet that if there were other orders of terrestrial vertebrates, they too would have been fossilized." James W. Valentine, a paleontologist with the University of California, found that 76.8% of the marine mollusk species currently living along the Southern California and Baja California coast are also found in the fossil record. Nonetheless, some of Darwin's most vocal supporters insist that the fossil record is radically incomplete. In his textbook, Evolution, 2005, Douglas J. Futuyma of SUNY Stony Brook said, "The fossil record is extremely incomplete for reasons that geologists understand well. Consequently, the transitional stages that we postulate in the origin of many higher taxa have not yet been found. But there is absolutely no truth to the claim made by many creationists that the fossil record does not provide any intermediate forms." Futuyma's is one of the leading college textbooks in the field. "There are many such intermediates," he said. "Animals called therapsids, for example, were intermediate between reptiles and mammals." He said it is the most beautifully documented example of the evolution of a major taxon. One problem is that the morphological sequence of therapsids does not match the temporal sequence. The fossils expected to be the most reptile-like should come earlier, but there are several inconsistencies. Futuyma also said the reptile-to-mammal transition is so abundantly documented that it is impossible to tell which therapsid species were the actual ancestors of mammals. But as Dembski and Wells commented, "If mammals arose from just one of those lineages, then the others were not ancestral. In that case, why should the similarity of characters be treated as evidence for ancestry? If the same mammal-like features of therapsids keep emerging without being related by common ancestry, then why should mammals be regarded as related to therapsids by common ancestry? As we saw in the previous chapter, a similar problem arises with convergence. Very similar or convergent characters appear in widely separated groups that no one thinks are related by ancestry. An important point is that fossils cannot distinguish between Darwin's claim that nature needs no designer and the alternative argument that it shows strong signs of having been designed. It is not that such a distinction cannot be made, but that fossils cannot make it. If it is reasonable to assume that a living organism needs no designer, then the same assumption equally applies to a fossil of that organism. In Science on Trial, 1983, Fatoima brought up another issue related to fossils, one that is often mentioned by Darwinians. Fossils tell us that there is an orderly history to life, he wrote. Different groups originated at different times. It is inconceivable that flowering plants or horses could have existed for hundreds of millions of years without leaving a trace, and then left a rich record thereafter. Brown University biologist and evolution crusader Kenneth Miller has made a similar argument. The appearance of life on Earth has a sequential character, and he cautioned that any theory of intelligent design must take these sequences into account. To put it plainly, if design is the explanation for life, then the designer has chosen to work gradually, assembling a living world over the course of hundreds of millions of years. Miller's and Fatoima's claim that life is orderly and sequential can certainly be taken as evidence for evolution, depending on how that word is defined. But it is also acceptable to those who are more skeptical. In a world of human artifacts, such as automobiles, cameras, and computers, design is always sequential. The Ford Mustang was designed 36 years after the Model A, two of the most successful Ford vehicles. Miller and others who are impressed by the temporal sequence of fossils never explain why they think designers are expected to do everything at the same time. It is one more instance of the evolutionist tendency to stray into theology. Their not quite stated position is that God, if he existed, should have been able to do everything at once. But if sequential design happens with human constructions, why should the sequential design of life itself be ruled out? Cambrian Explosion. An important discovery of new fossils was made by the American paleontologist Charles Doolittle Walcott in 1909. The fossils were embedded within the Burgess Shale in British Columbia. Dating to the Cambrian period, about 540 million years ago, they documented what became known as the Cambrian Explosion. They were extensively described by Harry B. Whittington, 1916 to 2010, a paleontologist at Cambridge University, and by his assistant Simon Conway Morris, now also at Cambridge. Stephen Jay Gould discussed their findings at some length in his book, Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale and the Nature of History, 1989. Almost all the animal phyla appear abruptly in the fossil record of the Cambrian. The Burgess Shale includes a range of disparity in anatomical design never again equaled and not matched today by all the creatures in all the world's oceans, Gould wrote. The large initial stock of animals was then decimated. Gould worried about that word because it seemed the phyla were in fact reduced by more than a tenth. And since then, the residue has dominated the history of multicellular life. Gould continued, "The story of the last 500 million years has featured restriction followed by proliferation within a few stereotyped designs. Not general expansion of range and increase in complexity, as our favored iconography, the cone of increasing diversity, implies." Gould felt free to criticize our favored iconography, but he could well have gone a step further and added that the iconography was the brainchild of Charles Darwin himself. Almost all the animal phyla appeared without known progenitors in the Cambrian era. The paleontologist James Valentine has estimated that at least 60 phyla appeared at that time and that more remain to be discovered. He also said this, "We consider these estimates to be very conservative. If they are in the correct general order, then the evolutionary events near the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary not only occurred with unexpected rapidity within lineages, but involved so many higher taxa as to form an evolutionary explosion without precedent, both rapid in pace and broad in scope. This near-instant explosion of body plans is the opposite of what Darwin's theory predicts. As he visualized the tree of life, the number of body plans, or phyla, should increase with time. Yet today, the number of phyla is estimated at about 30, perhaps half the number found in the Cambrian. Dembski and Wells wrote in The Design of Life that the more fossils paleontologists have found, the clearer it has become that they form a pattern at odds with Darwin's theory. The pattern is not a gradually branching tree, but a collection of clusters separated by gaps. Perhaps that should not be surprising. It is, after all, the same pattern we see among living organisms today. Any theory that attempts to account for the emergence of major taxonomic groups within the animal kingdom must explain how such a dramatic range of body plans appeared so abruptly. Eldridge and Gould's ideas about punctuated equilibrium also lent some support to these non-Darwinian views. A paleontologist with the American Museum of Natural History, Niles Eldridge, became an expert on trilobites, extinct marine arthropods, and the best known of the Cambrian fossils. Well-preserved trilobites are among the earliest animals found in the Cambrian. They have lens-focusing eyes with a 360-degree field of vision. Not so primitive, as Stephen Meyer wrote. At first it bothered Eldridge that the trilobites were all so similar. Then he concluded that the absence of change was itself significant. Stasis is data, as he put it. He was joined by Gould, and they theorized that animal body forms are static for long periods. Intermediate forms come and go so quickly that they leave little or no record. As a theory, punctuated equilibrium was formulated in 1972. Paleontologists had long observed lengthy periods of stasis in the fossil record. That stability is then interrupted by new species that restore a new equilibrium at a different level. It's as though life's history resembles a series of sharp steps instead of the gradual slope that Darwin had anticipated. Gould wrote in The Panda's Thumb, 1980, "The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. All paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt." Gould accepted that the intermediate forms once existed, though they were difficult to see in the fossil record. So neither he nor Eldridge should be confused with creationists. Still, they pointed to a real problem, which persists to this day. Interviewed at the American Museum of Natural History in the early 1980s, Don Rosen, 1929 to 1986, formerly chairman of the museum's Department of Ichthyology, summarized the dilemma for Darwinists. Darwin said that evolution happened too slowly for us to see it. Gould and Eldridge said that it happened too quickly for us to see it. Either way, we don't see it. Stephen M. Stanley, a paleontologist who for most of his career taught geology at Johns Hopkins University, agreed with Eldridge and Gould. But he went even further when he said in 1979, "The known fossil record fails to document a single example of phyletic evolution accomplishing a major morphological transition, and hence offers no evidence that the gradualistic model can be valid." Ernst Mayr complimented his junior colleagues when he said that evolutionary stasis had been unexpected by most evolutionary biologists, and that punctuated equilibrium had had a major impact on paleontology and evolutionary biology. Futuyma agreed. Species delimited in shape persist without appreciable change for millions of years, he said, and that is not limited to specific characters, but marks all the detectable morphological features. It is organism-wide, in other words. Fossils discovered in China in 1984 showed an even greater variety of Cambrian body plans, from layers of rock that were older than the Burgess Shale. They helped to establish that the Cambrian animals appeared even more explosively than previously realized, said Stephen Meyer. The Chinese fossils showed that the new phyla, new in the sense that they had no predecessors in the fossil record, appeared within a 10-million-year period. No plausible ancestors have yet been found in lower strata, whether in British Columbia or in China. What about the claim made by Darwin that forms lacking hard parts could not be expected to fossilize? The fact is that lots of pre-Cambrian soft-bodied organisms have been preserved, but they don't bring us closer to a solution. Others say that the explosive period took only 5 to 6 million years. How sudden is that? Compared with the reported 3 billion year history of life on Earth, the Cambrian explosion is the equivalent of 1 minute in a 24-hour day. It happened in the twinkling of an eye. Dembski and Wells commented, "The origin of new phyla represents evolution's greatest achievement in diversifying the forms of animal life. Yet the origin of new animal phyla is crammed into the first 1 or 2% of the animal fossil record." When the Chinese paleontologist J.Y. Chen discussed some of these findings at the University of Washington in Seattle more than a decade ago, he went out of his way to express doubts about the adequacy of Darwinism in accounting for what we see. The paleontologists in the audience ignored his doubts, and afterwards he asked a visitor why. The visitor told him it was very unpopular to doubt Darwinism in the U.S. He laughed and said, "In China, we can criticize Darwin, but not the government. In America, you can criticize the government, but not Darwin." Darwin knew about the Cambrian strata, which were originally discovered in Wales, not far from where he grew up in Shrewsbury. He also realized that unless closely related fossil sequences were found, his theory was in trouble. The difficulty of understanding the absence of vast piles of fossiliferous strata, which on my theory were no doubt somewhere accumulated before the Silurian epoch, now called the Middle Cambrian, is very great. I allude to the manner in which numbers of species of the same group suddenly appear in the lowest known fossiliferous rocks. So the problem has been understood for 150 years. Others have recently drawn attention to it. Douglas Irwin's and James Valentine's The Cambrian Explosion, The Construction of Animal Biodiversity, 2013, was published a few months before Stephen Meyer's book. They agree that no one has found the missing fossils or plausibly suggested how the new body plans arose so quickly. Both Irwin and Valentine have questioned the ability of conventional evolutionary theory to explain what the fossils tell us. Irwin at the Smithsonian and another colleague, Eric Davidson of Caltech, have now ruled out standard neo-Darwinian theory, vehemently in Davidson's case, Meyer wrote. In spite of this, Irwin, Valentine, and Davidson remain Darwinians in the broader sense. The paleontologist David Raup said in 1979 that although our knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded since Darwin's time, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transitions now than we did then. Some of the classic transitions in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. Fossil remains spread across the history of life confirm evolution if that is simply taken to mean change over time. But a more detailed look shows the fossil record to be more of an obstacle than a confirmation of what is entailed by Darwin's theory. Chapter 12. Evolution and Systematics at the American Museum. The Systematics Discussion Group used to meet every month at New York's American Museum of Natural History. A systematics discussion doesn't sound terribly interesting, but sometimes it is. And one evening, in the fall of 1981, it was. The speaker was Colin Patterson, a senior paleontologist at the Natural History Museum in London. Later, he became a fellow of the Royal Society. He was invited to the American Museum by Don E. Rosen, who had recently been chairman of the ichthyology department there. Both were strongly supported by Gareth Nelson, himself later a chairman of ichthyology. Another supporter was Norman Platnick, an entomologist at the American Museum and one of the world's foremost experts on spiders. Patterson's talk created a huge controversy. For that reason, the written version of his speech was published in 2002 by the Linnean, which is the version quoted here. Patterson died of a heart attack in 1998 as he bicycled to the British Museum in London. He was 64 years old. By then, I had interviewed him several times. Philip Johnson, the godfather of what later became the intelligent design movement, also interviewed Patterson in London in 1988. First, an overview. Systematics is the study of the relationships between organisms. It is not quite the same thing as taxonomy, which identifies and names the various species and groups. According to the book of Genesis, naming the animals was a task first assigned to Adam. God brought him the species to see what he would call them, and whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. Genesis notwithstanding, Patterson's views had nothing to do with the Bible or religious faith. He told me that he was an atheist, and once referred to the belief system underlying the Church of England as a pack of lies. Discerning the difference between varieties, species, and families as a preliminary to naming them is a difficult exercise, so Adam had his work cut out for him. But determining the relationships between these groups is even more difficult. Since Darwin's time, it has usually resolved itself into a search for ancestors. But Patterson, Nelson, Platnick, and others concluded that, in the absence of birth records and the like, ancestry is not something that can be determined. The concept of ancestry is not accessible by the tools that we have, Patterson once said. People can get together for a family reunion on the basis of family records or immediate recollections. But in nature, there are no such records or memories. There are only fossils. In his book Human Diversity, 1982, Harvard's Richard Lewontin lent support to this idea. Despite the excited and optimistic claims that have been made by some paleontologists, he wrote, no fossil hominid species can be established as our direct ancestor. When I discussed this with Lewontin, he brought up a little-noted contradiction in the search for ancestors. If it is different enough from humans to be interesting, then you don't know whether it's an ancestor or not, he said. If it's similar enough to be human, then it's not interesting. His argument, of course, applies to all fossils, not just hominids. Systematics and cladistics. Colin Patterson, Gary Nelson, and others belong to a group of systematists called cladists. True to form, cladists are themselves divided into different groups. The group we are interested in, sometimes called transformed cladists, dispense with all assumptions about ancestry. They say that ancestry, and therefore phylogeny, cannot be determined until we first identify the characters of each group. So they study them without asking which came first. An analogy might be to say that it makes no sense to ask whether one word should precede another in an alphabetical dictionary until we know exactly how both words are spelled. The founding father of what became known as cladistics was Willy Hennig, 1913 to 1976. An entomologist who lived in East Germany. His best-known work, Phylogenetic Systematics, was reprinted by the University of Illinois in 1966. It's a difficult book with a lot of technical terms, most of which I shall try to avoid. Cladists study patterns. They use a criterion of parsimony to decide which traits deserve more weight than others. It's not difficult to appreciate that all this quickly becomes complicated. At times, Patterson's talk reflected that complexity, but I shall try to avoid the difficulties. Illustrating his point that characters make a difference to the way species are related, Patterson brought up the great hippocampus question, discussed in Charles Kingsley's children's book, The Water Babies, 1863. In fact, not in fiction, Patterson added, Kingsley had elaborated on a controversy pursued in 1861 to 1862 by Richard Owen and T.H. Huxley. Richard Owen, the creationist, insisted that man was quite distinct from the apes and couldn't be related to them by descent, because the brain of man contained a certain center, the hippocampus, that was absent in apes. The row went on for 2 years, Patterson said, and, as usual, Huxley won. But more recently, there had been a reversal. Another comment from Patterson. Here we are, 120 years later, and we have Mayer, the evolutionist, insisting that man is quite distinct from the apes, because the brain of man contains Broca's center that is absent in apes. Mayer goes on to cite J. Huxley. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yet notice how the roles have become reversed. The part of Owen, the creationist, with the hippocampus, is now taken by Mayer, the evolutionist, with Broca's center. Evolution and creation. The controversy in Patterson's talk was initiated by Don Rosen, who had suggested that it should be titled Evolutionism and Creationism. That was why Patterson introduced those sharply opposing characters, Mayer and Owen. Most of Patterson's controversial remarks came early in his talk, and here is the part that set off the controversy. Usually, when I get up to speak on some subject, I've been confident of one thing, that I know more about it than anybody in the room. I don't have that confidence today. I'm tackling two subjects about which I feel I know nothing at all. One of the reasons I started taking a non-evolutionary view was my sudden realization that after working, as I thought, on evolution for 20 years, that I knew nothing whatever about it. It was quite a shock to learn that one could be so misled for so long. Either there was something wrong with me, or there was something wrong with evolution. And naturally, I suppose there is nothing wrong with me. Over the last few weeks, I've tried putting a question to various people and groups of people. The question is, can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one statement that seems to be true? I tried that question on the geology staff in the Field Museum of Natural History and got no answer. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar in the University of Chicago. After a long silence, one person said, "I know it ought not to be taught in high school. I wonder if anyone here has a better answer." The only other answer I've got from anyone, and I've had this from several people, like Ken Campbell and Jim Hobson, is convergence is rampant. It's everywhere. I'll come to convergence later, but the level of knowledge about evolution is pretty low. We know it ought not to be taught in high school, and that's about all. What about creationism? I suppose we know the same fact about it, that it ought not to be taught in high school. And that's about the lot. I'm not interested in the controversy over high school teaching. And if any militant creationists have come here looking for political ammunition, I hope they will be disappointed. Patterson added that this was the systematics discussion group, so he would try to concentrate on that. Then he brought up Neil Gillespie's book, Charles Darwin and the Problem of Creation, 1979, which would provide the text for his talk. Gillespie's book tried to account for the amount of space that Darwin gave in The Origin to combating the creationist argument. Darwin was trying to substitute a view of the world in which there was no need for final causes and no room for them. a view of the world in which there was no purpose in nature. Patterson added that Gillespie took it for granted that Darwin and his disciples had succeeded in this task. In short, a rationalist view of nature has replaced an irrational one. I myself took that view for granted until about 18 months ago, Patterson went on. He continued as follows. I woke up and realized that all my life I had been duped into thinking of evolution as revealed truth. From my new viewpoint, some of Gillespie's comments seem very apt. When I transpose them from the period he's talking about, the 1850s, to the 1970s and 1980s. Gillespie had said that from a materialistic perspective, creationism is an anti-theory, something that has the function of knowledge but conveys none. But what about evolution? Replying to his own question, Patterson said, "Evolution has the function of knowledge, but does it actually convey any? Well, we're back to the question I've been putting to people. Can you tell me one thing about evolution?" And the absence of answers seems to show that indeed no knowledge has been conveyed. Here we all are with all our shelves full of books on evolution, and yet we seem to have learned nothing from them, as I learned nothing from what I thought was over 20 years of work on evolution. Gillespie's comment, "A void that has the function of knowledge but conveys none," seems very apt. Paraphyletic groups. Patterson then made what was surely his most important point, a critique of some well-known evolutionary claims. But his comments may have proceeded too quickly, and probably got buried amidst the general tumult and interruptions. First, in Patterson's words, "In systematics, there are pieces of evolutionary knowledge that all our heads are stuffed with, from the most general, statements like eukaryotes evolved from prokaryotes, or vertebrates evolved from invertebrates, down to lower-level statements like man evolved from apes. I imagine that by now you all appreciate that such statements exactly fit Gillespie's description, voids that have the function of knowledge but convey none." His claim was not further discussed, and while this group may well have appreciated the weakness of those evolutionist claims, laymen today are likely to have missed the point. Why are such statements voids exactly? Patterson went on to explain, but again, perhaps too hurriedly. "Because when analyzed, all such statements say that there is a group, a real group with characters, eukaryotes, vertebrates, Homo sapiens, whatever, opposed to a non-group, prokaryotes, invertebrates, apes, or whatever, abstractions that have no characters, no existence in nature, and convey no knowledge, although they appear to." Let me go over that again by asking another question. Why are such groups as invertebrates non-groups? Why do they have no existence in nature? The answer is that they are all misleadingly identified by the absence of characters. The point is best appreciated by considering the simple sentence, "Vertebrates evolved from invertebrates." The problem is that "from invertebrates" adds nothing new to what is already asserted as true in the first two words. The last two words seem to validate the claim that evolution has been observed by identifying the ancestral group. It's a veiled assertion that an instance of evolution has been identified. The claim is made more plausible by naming the ancestral group. The problem is that when vertebrates evolved for the first time, the ancestral species must have been a non-vertebrate. Otherwise, the newly evolved vertebrate wouldn't have been the first one. So what we are seeing is not a factual claim, but a disguised truism. At the end of the day, we still have no idea how to identify the species that the first vertebrate evolved from. We are told that it was not a vertebrate, that it was an invertebrate. But we knew that already. The same problem arises when we claim that humans evolved from apes. First, there is a group consisting of humans, chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans. the hominidae. If humans are excluded from that group, the remaining group is called apes. If the question is then asked, what did humans evolve from? The logical answer is that they evolved from non-human hominidae, otherwise known as apes. It's a disguised way of saying that humans evolved from non-humans, which again, on evolutionary assumptions, we knew already. The same emptiness appears in the claim that mammals and birds evolved from reptiles. Reptiles are non-mammalian, non-avian amniotes, and so, logically enough, birds and mammals, also amniotes, and therefore requiring amniote ancestors, are said to have evolved from them, another truism that contains no real knowledge. Willy Hennig invented the word paraphyly in 1962 to identify groups with absent characters, but according to ichthyologist Gary Nelson, it was Patterson who was the first to identify the ancestral groups of traditional evolutionary theory as paraphyletic, that is, as lacking the characters that are said to have evolved in the descendant group. Asked in a BBC interview what he thought of transformed cladistics, the British biologist Beverly Halstead replied, "Well, I object to it. I mean, this is going back to Aristotle. It is not pre-Darwinian, it is Aristotelian. From Darwin's day to the present, we've understood there's a time element. We've begun to understand evolution. What they are doing in transformed cladistics is to say, let's forget about evolution. Let's forget about process. Let's simply consider pattern." In On the Parts of Animals, Aristotle wrote that there can be no specific forms of what is non-existent, of featherless, for instance, or of footless, as there are of feathered or footed. Nelson and Platnick. I spent some time talking to Gareth Nelson and Norman Platnick. In Nelson's office, a table was covered with papers and jars stuffed with small silvery fish, anchovies, preserved in alcohol. At that time, Nelson was just about the world's expert on anchovies, although he told me that the number of people studying them, 3 or 4, is a small fraction of the number of anchovy species, 150 known species, and probably many more in reality. This disparity between the magnitude of the problem and the number of people working on it is surprisingly common in biology. Most laymen think that the experts have exhaustively studied life on Earth when they have barely scratched the surface. What about the fossil record? In an automobile museum, you can find the ancestors of contemporary cars lined up in sequence, Thunderbird back to Model T. Doesn't that apply to extinct animals, too? I asked Nelson. Usually with fossils, all you find are a few nuts and bolts, he said. An odd piston ring, maybe, or different pieces of a carburetor that are spread out or piled on top of one another, but not in their correct arrangement. Too much importance has been attached to fossils, he said, and it's easy to understand why. You put in all this effort studying them, and you get out a little bit. Therefore, you are persuaded that that little bit must be very important. I can get 10 times more information per unit with recent fishes. He said it was common for paleontologists to go to the trouble of digging up fossils without realizing that the animals in question were still walking about. Say you dig up a 50-million-year-old beetle, he said. It looks like it belongs to a certain family, but there may be 30,000 species in the family. What do? Go through all 30,000? No, you just give it an appropriate-sounding name. Eocoleoptera, say. If it is one that has been in existence for 50 million years, somebody else will have to find that out, because you don't have enough time. You're out digging in the rocks, not poking through beetle collections in museums. When I asked about anchovy fossils, he said that a graduate student at the museum studied the question, and it turned out that all the fossils previously described as anchovies are not anchovies at all. So the fossil record of anchovies was reduced to 0. But then they found one in the British Museum, maybe 10 million years old, from the Miocene in Cyprus. it turns out to be the only known anchovy fossil. There is information suggesting it is the same kind of animal we find inhabiting the Mediterranean today, Nelson said. Norman Platnick's office was on the fifth floor of the American Museum. Here, spiders, dead, were inside labeled bottles. Journal articles were neatly stacked. Platnick told me that when he was an undergraduate at a small Appalachian college, he would go along with his wife when she collected millipedes. But when we arrived home, all I would have in my jars would be spiders. So he studied them. Now he has a PhD from Harvard, and he and Nelson are co-authors of a difficult book, Systematics and Biogeography, Cladistics and Vicariance. Spiders, which go back to the Devonian period, 400 million years ago, belong to the class Arachnida. They are among the invertebrates, in other words, and they are not well preserved in the fossil record. About 35,000 species of spiders have been identified, Platnick said, but there may be three times that many in the world. He thought that there were perhaps four full-time systematists examining spiders in the United States. The American Arachnological Society had 475 members worldwide, some of them amateurs. They meet once a year and discuss scorpions and daddy longlegs, as well as spiders. Most of the spiders I look at may have been looked at by two or three people in history, Platnick said, adding that he would most likely be dead before anyone looked at them again. When I asked what was known about spider ancestry, he said, "Very little. We still don't know a hill of beans about that. We certainly don't know what species was ancestral to the first spider. We don't even know of any links in the presumed 400 million year chain of spider ancestry. I do not ever say that this spider is ancestral to that one," Platnick said. In fact, he didn't know of a single case in the modern literature where it's claimed that one spider is the ancestor of another. Some spiders have been well preserved in amber. Even so, Platnick said, very few spider fossils have been so well preserved that you can put a species name on them. Like Nelson, he said, you don't learn much from fossils. The point stressed by Platnick and Nelson is that unless we know the relationships between organisms, what makes each unique and different from others, we cannot possibly know their ancestral relationships. Things in nature here and now must be ranked according to their taxonomic relationship, before they can be placed in a family tree. Whether we will ever fill in those gaps is something that Platnick could not answer. One problem is the shortage of taxonomists. Systematics, he said, doesn't have the glamour to attract research funds. Grants have increasingly gone to molecular and biochemical studies. The result is that support for taxonomy at many institutions has withered away. He added, "I am fully prepared to resist any biologist who says evolutionary theory is more important or more basic. But without the results of systematics, there is nothing to be explained." A theory held very dear. A year or two later, I asked Patterson what he thought about his talk and the reaction to it. He answered, "I was all fired up, and I said what I thought. I went through merry hell for about a year. Almost everybody except the people at the British Museum objected. Lots of academics wrote, 'Deluges of mail. Here we are trying to combat a political argument,' they said, and you give them ammunition. One has to live with one's colleagues. They hold the theory very dear. I found out that what you say will be taken in political rather than rational terms." Patterson told me that he regarded the theory of evolution as often unnecessary in biology. In fact, he said, they could do perfectly well without it. Nevertheless, he said, it was presented in textbooks as though it were the unified field theory of biology, holding the whole subject together and binding the profession to it. Once something has that status, he said, it becomes like religion. When I asked him if he believed in evolution himself, he replied, "Well, isn't it strange that this is what it comes to, that you have to ask me whether I believe it, as if it mattered whether I believe it or not? Yes, I do believe it, But in saying that, it is obvious that it is a faith. The complex organisms that he studied certainly exist. And as an atheist, he had little choice but to accept that they assembled themselves one small bit at a time. But the fossil record gives little or no support